Engineers Without Borders UK are working to reach the tipping point to ensure a safe and just future for all. Part of a global movement of over 60 Engineers Without Borders organisations, they inspire, upskill, and drive change in the engineering community, and together take action to put global responsibility at the heart of engineering.
Welcome to the Materials Inside podcast by Goodfellow, the podcast that will bring materials knowledge, science, and engineering together in the same podcast. Goodfellow is a UK company based in Huntingdon that supplies over 70,000 materials to different industries all around the world. Their team of scientists, engineers, sales, and marketing experts want to make the materials world accessible to everyone. During the next few months, we will be talking about materials from aluminium to zinc for applications from satellites to planes, cars and ventilators, pieces of art and furniture. The range of guests from industry professionals, public figures, engineers and Goodfellow's own experts. These include series regulars Aphrodite Tomu, Goodfellow's technical manager, who's a material scientist and engineer holding a PhD in nanocomposites and a master's in nanomaterials and metal thin films, and Adam Sells, sales manager with a degree in chemistry responsible for a team of business development managers working with customers around the world. Materials Inside, with Goodfellow's backing, will be supporting a charity throughout each series.
Welcome back to the Materials Inside podcast. Today we're going to be discussing artificial intelligence with some really interesting guests. Later, we'll be joined by Dr. Philip Woolston, who is a senior chemist at Domino Printing Sciences. Philip has been using artificial intelligence within his research, and we'll be hearing more about that later. First, we are joined by Gareth Conduit, who is CSO at Intelligens. He will be giving some amazing insights into the AI world and explaining what artificial intelligence really is. But before that, let me introduce you to my colleague Mark Daniels, who is CRM manager within the marketing team. Mark joined Goodfellow this year and has already made a strong impact on improving our emailing systems. Mark has a passion for AI, and so he will be guest presenting this episode.
Thanks very much, Peter. Gareth, good morning. Welcome to Goodfellow's Materials Inside podcast. How are you this morning?
I'm very good, thank you, Mark. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. So before we get too far into the questions I've got for you, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, just a bit about you and your background before we get into the intelligence piece?
Yes, certainly. Thank you, Mark. And I must say it's really great that you're hosting us today. So I'm a researcher, a long-term research fellow here at the University of Cambridge, and I kicked off my research in very exotic materials such as superconductors and low-temperature magnets. But during that research program, I happened across a serendipitous research collaboration with researchers over at the Rolls-Royce University Technology Centre, which motivated me to get into proper real-life commercial materials, and we developed our machine learning methodology in order to thrive in that circumstance. So I was then fortunate to get a series of contracts through the university with various materials companies, including Rolls-Royce, Samsung and BP, and once we'd built our machine learning technology, seen that it was working really well, I was then encouraged to go out and take the technology out into the marketplace. At that point, I co-founded Intelligens, and there I'm now the chief scientific officer, where I'm really driving forward the further development of our machine learning tool, Alchemite.
Wow, that's fantastic. What an interesting background, interesting career. So you're doing the two in tandem, Cambridge University and Intelligens.
Yeah, you're quite right there. And I'm very fortunate that the position in the university is flexible and that the two research programmes are really harmonious. That in the university, we're really trying to drive forward, extracting as much information out of data as possible, which is almost quite an algorithmic research program. And then over in Intelligens, we're trying to take that into the real life marketplace to make it work in those really practical circumstances of our customers.
Fantastic. So look, you've mentioned machine learning a few times, and I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But before we do come to that and a couple of other questions I've got around that area, can we just dig a little bit deeper into intelligence itself? What are the goals of the company? What have you achieved so far, and what's your aim?
Oh, so our goal is to develop advanced machine learning methods that can be applied and solve real-life problems, which are typically found in the pharmaceutical industry, the industrial chemical industry, and also in materials. So we provide both the back-end bespoke machine learning tool to do that, a API to allow our customers to integrate that into their software stack, and also the intuitive front end for sort of engineers to just upload their data and to get a move on and get the answers. Now, for us, the measure of our success is whether the materials that our tool proposes actually work in real life and make it out into the commercial sort of marketplace. And the strength of our technology in achieving that goal is really evidenced both by many of the academic papers that have been written about materials that we have designed and have been experimentally validated and sold, and also a couple of prizes. I'll highlight a couple. We won the open source malaria drug competition in proposing a new anti-malaria drug that was then synthesized and shown to have really strong activity against its target. And also last year, we were fortunate to win the American Society of Mechanical Engineers prizes, both for Startup of the Year and also Software Company of the Year, on the basis of some materials that we had designed for additive manufacturing.
Well, congratulations. That's absolutely fantastic. And actually, I'll come back to that a little bit, because we're talking about, obviously, materials here as part of Goodfellow's thing. But before we get too far into it, I'm probably going to oversimplify this a little bit, so forgive me. You've mentioned machine learning a couple of times there, and sometimes people don't know the difference between machine learning and artificial intelligence as two things. And there's a couple of views I have on that. One, as a marketer, I've often said that I ask for budget for artificial intelligence because I'll get money for it, whereas if I ask for budget for machine learning, nobody gives me any money for it. But can you tell me what's the actual difference, or what's your view of the difference between artificial intelligence and machine learning? And indeed, does artificial intelligence exist?
Now, I think that's a really fantastic question. And from our point of view, artificial intelligence is an attempt to replicate the human brain, but typically on a computer. So we think it's some common tasks that a human would do, like driving a car. Then if instead we can get those autonomous vehicles to really work well, then the computer program behind it has replaced a human. So we would see that as artificial intelligence. Now, of course, those autonomous vehicles, you'd say, are working in a certain circumstance, in some sort of environments in which they're used to, being trained on. And so in that way, you could say, yes, that some progress has been made toward replacing the task of human in those very specific circumstances. Now, on the flip side, machine learning, we would see it as taking some existing data, and rather than a human drawing a curve through it, to get the machine to learn that trend, to learn the behavior behind that curve. So if you then give it a new value on the x-axis of the curve, it will be able to predict the y-axis to avoid needing to, in our case, perform another experiment. And at Intelligent, we could view that we're kind of doing both, that I think we're closest to machine learning in taking historical data, trying to predict, learn about materials from it, predict what a new experiment would do before having to perform it. But also there's a little bit of artificial intelligence there, that some of the materials design work is historically done by a very clever material scientist who has spent years understanding the trends in materials, understanding what's going on under the hood. And we're now also attempting to partially complement that and empower that role.
That was actually a really comprehensive and good description of the difference. Because if you step outside of our field of science, etc., the general public's view of artificial intelligence is heavily influenced by science fiction and, you know, the Skynets and Terminators, etc. But in your experience, how is it actually used in scientific research? Is that artificial intelligence in research, or is that machine learning?
Well, from our point of view, I think it's more on the machine learning side. where we're sort of trying to empower to make scientists' lives easier, and we just see it as the next sort of generation of well-established tools that maybe 60, 70 years ago, or the scientists, we had their table of numbers written down on a sheet of paper, and they were using a slide rule to do calculations. Then the electronic calculator came along, and then the spreadsheet on a computer where you can more neatly curate your data and plot graphs of it. And now our machine learning, we believe, is just the next generation of those tools. It's like a spreadsheet on steroids that both stores the data, but they can extract much more sort of information and give much deeper insights into it.
Fantastic. So you mentioned that it's like a spreadsheet on steroids. So is that the differentiator about the machine learning that you've developed at Intelligence, or is there more than that to it?
Well, I think there's more, certainly a lot more to it than that. That maybe a standard machine learning tools that you can download on just from the internet are a spreadsheet on steroids, but they require very clean data that would be a perfectly complete spreadsheet. But unfortunately, in the kinds of real life systems, these material systems that our customers are working in, things are never that easy. And in fact, we think there's probably three big problems, big challenges that are faced. The first of which is that typically the data that comes out of experiments, the historical data, is going to be noisy. And it's an experiment, there's uncertainty on that measurement, we don't quite know what the value is, and that noise is a real killer to standard machine learning tools, because it will get confused by the random wiggles in the noise, and noise on those inputs just leads to an uncertain output. And then secondly, in materials, there's typically a lot of properties that need to be predicted. We've got to actually find a useful material, it's got to be simultaneously, say, strong, it's got to be light, it's got to be corrosion resistant, it's got to be cheap. And we need to be able to simultaneously understand and predict all of those different properties, which means we're going to need a very flexible approach that can to handle those different kinds of data and different trends all at the same time. And the third is, if we imagine our spreadsheet of historical data, where each row is a separate material and each column a separate property, then for that historical data, it would usually be that not every property has been measured, that the first row might have come from a particular experimental campaign the company had in the past, where they were interested in the corrosion resistance of the materials. They certainly measured that, but they didn't bother to measure the strength because it wasn't necessary at the time. So that data is just missing. And so our spreadsheet's going to have lots and lots of gaps in it, and that sparsity is going to make it really difficult to apply standard machine learning methods, because they're just maths formally, and all maths formally need the inputs to give an output.
We're going to be talking with Dr. Philip Woolston from Domino Printing Science later, and I read their case study on the work they'd done with you, and one of their biggest challenges was the sparsity of data, wasn't it?
Well, absolutely, and I think that this is a very common sort of problem. In the most extreme circumstances, the data sheets are maybe 0.05% complete. And in one example that we've done in additive manufacturing, there was fewer data points on the input for a particular property, it's the number of cracks formed on printing, than there were actually input variables that we needed to specify, like composition and processing parameters. So we had to get more numbers out than we could put in, which from school level math sounds mathematically impossible. But that's where we were able to turn the problem on its head, and this is where we've had to develop the bespoke machine learning methods to overcome these challenges. It can overcome sparse data by taking advantage of the fact there are lots of properties, and when properties are often correlated to each other, like a hard material is often strong, then it can use one result that has been measured to help inform what that missing result is. And we can overcome the noise by understanding the uncertainty of our predictions very carefully, and then focusing our customers down onto where there's least uncertainty, where there's the most robustness, the material is actually most likely to work. And they're all bespoke requirements that we've had to set up, so very special to get machine learning to work in these real-life circumstances, including with Domino.
Exactly. Now, obviously, we've talked a bit about materials there as you've gone along, and from Goodfellow's perspective, we're most interested in the materials research. So you've given a little bit of an example there, but can you expand on that at all? Can you give me some more examples of how you've helped with materials research? Does it help bring their costs down on production or later development, the research time itself?
No, sir, absolutely. Yeah, so this is the real crux of the benefits of our method, is avoiding the need to perform additional really expensive and time-consuming experiments. So, for example, in our first project with Rolls-Royce, we were tasked with designing high-temperature alloys for use in the heart of their engines. There, it might typically take around 20 years to design a material that Rolls-Royce operate through universities, and a professor and a series of PhD students would make, the professor would guess, and then they make a material, and then they go around in circles until they eventually hit upon the material. By when Rolls-Royce have changed what they actually wanted the material to achieve, the design of the engines moved on, and the old material is, though excellent, is no use. So we came in and then we applied our machine learning tool to that system, and we were able to design and validate the material in less than a year. So cut from 20 years down to 1 year, and perhaps of $10, $20, $30 million or so down to the cost of that project was of order $100,000. So that's an enormous saving for Rolls-Royce. And that's just one example you can read about online. That one's published in peer-reviewed paper. And then there's the additive manufacturing one you'll hear later about Domino. And another one we can speak about publicly is designing materials for use in batteries, where we were merging together experimental data and first principles computer simulations that could be performed on them. And that led to significant savings for, in that case, initially we were working with Samsung.
You mentioned Samsung there and obviously Rolls-Royce. What was going through my head then with your product is, with the advent of the automotive industry moving towards electric vehicles, for somebody like Rolls-Royce with battery technology, this must be super powerful for them as well.
Absolutely. And of course, these are almost brand new types of batteries that are having to be developed. And there's very little historical data on the direct system they're interested in. And for us, that's even more exciting, because that means that the data set is necessarily sparse, because only a year or so of experiments have ever been performed on them. And that's where our tool can be even more helpful to extract more information from that sparse data set than other methods could, but also to help guide them on what experiments should they do next in order to understand, or to train a better machine learning model, to understand their system better, so that in 2 years' time, they will then be well positioned to design new materials.
I think it's absolutely fascinating, Gareth. I think this is quite exciting for the future of pretty much every industry, I would guess. One of the things that people always think, and it's always been a case of technology, as technology has developed since tech started, do you see this as replacing human beings? Do you see this as replacing researchers?
So absolutely not. I see it as really empowering the researchers. That at the moment, to do their job of research, rather than do some of the more tedious and time-consuming data analysis, that our machine learning tool will take in the data, will fit it extremely carefully, will extract as much information out of it as possible, and then we'll be able to provide completely, actually impartial and honest advice as such to those end users of exactly what can be told from the data and what cannot. And that will then inform the researchers to be able to use the thing that machine learning's not so strong at, like human creativity, to have really deep physical insight, to make analogies to completely to phenomenon, completely different disciplines, so that they can be really creative and drive forward with developing that next generation of materials.
So it's basically just allowing us to be cleverer and quicker and more efficient with our advancement, which is something that's hugely important at the moment in the progress of the world and going cleaner and greener, I guess. So we're coming to the end of our time, Gareth. It's been fascinating. I've got a couple of questions just to sort of wrap up with you, if that's okay. We've talked a lot about materials and the development of your software helping with the development of materials. How do you think the application of this might develop further? Where do you think it might go beyond materials?
Yes, I think we're really excited about other applications. What we've really developed is a completely generic tool that's good at handling sparse data, that's good at handling noisy data, but it doesn't mind what type of data that is. And so we've been thinking about other fields in which we can sort of have a real impact. So I mentioned earlier pharmaceuticals that have been working with companies, with lots of companies to develop sort of new drugs with a separate product there. We've been working in healthcare to be able to improve the efficiency of human trials to make sure that the human trials can be done on the right, sort of the humans with the right conditions to learn as much as possible from that human trial to sort of get the certification of the drug done as quickly as possible. We can think about sort of improving the sort of retail, the supply chain, to bring together information about what sells well in different shops in order to be able to maximise sales for our customers. And so we're really excited about these applications in areas of, that have the common thread of that sparse data.
My last question written down is what does the future hold for intelligence? But I think you've just told me it.
Part of it is to drive forward into those other application areas. We need to work very hard to make sure we're really at the bleeding edge of machine learning, that there are other ways we're working on to extract even more information out of the data that is already available to give better predictions to our customers. And then, of course, improving the front end of our software tool to really make it even more powerful and easy to use for say people on the factory floor, so they get it as close as possible to that production line.
Excellent. Gareth, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining me on the podcast. This has been such an interesting and mind-blowing conversation for me to sort of go through. Excellent. I wish you all the best in the future with intelligence, and I look forward to seeing how the technology develops as we go forward.
No, thank you very much for having me today, Mark. It's been a really cool chat.
One of the things we've been doing in the Goodfellow Marketing Department is working to ensure you have the best experience when interacting with us online. We've recently introduced a new email marketing platform to improve the quality and relevance of the content we send to you. Over the coming weeks and months, you'll see more specific emails relevant to you and your industry. If you already receive emails from Goodfellow, you'll notice that the email address we send you news and information from has changed. So if you haven't seen anything from us lately, please do check your spam folders for emails from the address info@email.goodfellow.news. If you haven't signed up to our newsletter before, head over to goodfellow.com. Not only will you find a rich amount of information on the products and services we can support you with, but you'll also be able to sign up to receive news and information from us. And we'll keep you up to date when our next podcast is released too. Philip, good morning. Welcome to Goodfellow's Materials Inside podcast. Hope you're well.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much for inviting me on. I think it's really great what you and the team are doing with this podcast. So looking forward to having a chat.
Thank you. Brilliant. So for the listeners, this is Dr. Philip Woolston, Senior Chemist at Domino Printing Sciences. Before we get too far into the questions in our conversation, Philip, can you just sort of tell me a little bit more about yourself, your role at Domino Printing Sciences, and just a little bit about your background?
Yeah, sure. So about me, I am trained as a chemist. I did my undergraduate degree up at University of York. During the undergraduate degree, I was able to go for a year in industry where I spent some time at AkzoNobel making paint, and that really was my first exposure to formulation science. I got quite a interest in kind of how nanoscale and microscale particulate matter can influence macroscale materials that we can kind of touch and see. And that led me to do a PhD over at the Colloidal Group Centre at the University of Bristol. That kind of further my interest within kind of colloidal science. So again, looking at how nanoscale changes in particles can influence macroscale, because I was looking at rods and plates forming liquid crystals, which was quite aesthetically pleasing to me. From there, I didn't really get a bug for academia, so I decided to go back to industry, and I thought I'd make best use of my knowledge around colloids in printing ink, and so that's why I ended up coming to Domino, as I felt like I could be a valued member of the team. That was kind of how I became a formulation chemist. I did a couple of years doing that, and I'm happy to say I've made a few inks that went onto the market. Over the time here at Domino, I've felt that one of my passions was really around data science and how we can make the best use of our data sets that we're generating. So I've headed towards more being a data scientist, I'll say, than more of a lab-based chemist, and really started to help the team understand how we can better use the data to inform our decisions that we make.
Fantastic. So we'll come back to the data and data sets in a little bit. You mentioned nanoscale and macroscale there. As I'm always keen to say to anybody who I'm talking to, I'm not a scientist. My background is in marketing. I understand that nano and macro mean very small, but what does that actually mean in your world? What is nano in the ink world?
So to us, we're very much considering the pigments and the colorants that we add into our inks. They're typically small, insoluble material, and that's on kind of the 100 nanometer scale. So these are individual things that you couldn't see with a human eye, even looking through microscopes. And then, as I say, when talking about the macro scale, I mean the kind of properties that you can actually see with your eyes, so the physical ink drop. And so, as I say, I'm very interested in how small changes in the nanoscale for the particulate matter can influence what we actually touch and see and the properties that we can measure.
Excellent. Okay, that's really good. And research being in inks, for most of us, you know, in our day-to-day life, ink is just something that's in a pen or, you know, something like that. What is it you're actually trying to achieve with inks? How will this impact somebody's everyday life?
Sure. So I guess going through what we do at Domino, it's worth clarifying when I'm talking about printers and inks, what we do is not the printers and inks that you're maybe used to in your home or office. We're dealing very much with the industrial scale printing for a production line. So our printers are typically used for the use-by dates, and these are really high throughput, relatively low resolution codes that you can print, I guess, maybe 10 per second on a production line. So it's about really high throughput. And at Domino, we're also very keen to enable solutions to go from the what we would call primary packaging. So these are the things that the end consumer would hold in their hands, such as a can or a chocolate bar. And we'll like to provide packaging solutions all the way up to the tertiary packaging. So these are the big pallets that you would end up shipping to your supermarkets. So as a company, we're very keen to make both the ink and the printers. And we really want to offer clarity to our customers so that there's a good confidence in what we're able to achieve in terms of the uptime for their production line, but also the confidence that it is something for non-direct food packaging. None of the chemicals in the ink will actually migrate through onto the food that the end user will consume.
So your research is basically in, you know, if I walk into the local supermarket and pick up something, you've probably had a hand in that somewhere along the line.
Yeah, I'd say it's very unlikely that someone would go a day without being able to touch a product that Domino have had some hand at, whether or not it's the use-by dates on eggs. We're very prevalent in that market, but as I say, all consumer goods. I would say as a company, we can't claim that we did much for COVID research, but what we certainly found was with the uptake of PPE and even the testing kits that went around, all of those would have traceability codes that would need to be put on so that there's confidence in how they were manufactured and that they are what they say they are. And these are the sort of codes that Domino are very good at producing for our customers.
Okay, so and just thinking that through a little bit further, in terms of if you think, if I put my environmental hat on for a second, for example, when you're talking about, you mentioned making sure the ink doesn't bleed through to the produce, but presumably you have to take into account the environmental impact of the ink as well?
Absolutely, that's a really good point. We're doing quite a few projects at the moment understanding the life cycle analysis of the inks that we generate. So from the raw materials that are mined out of the ground that we will put into the ink, some of our inks are solvent-based, so they will inherently have volatile organic content that's going to evaporate into the atmosphere. And with the push towards recycling and reusing a lot of packaging, we want to make sure that our inks don't have any influence on that process. So we want to make sure that the colorants can be bleached out and the material is able to be reused. We appreciate very much that as we are dealing with production lines, our business basically comes from consumerism. So whilst we want to make sure that customers are able to use products, we want to make sure that they're able to have confidence that the impact is minimized on the environment.
Excellent. Well, okay, so that's good. And in the process of doing that, I know that you've, or understand you've used artificial intelligence methods in the research, machine learning to be specific. If I can be a little bit flippant, I once heard a professor, I can't remember where it was, I must admit, but I heard the quote that artificial intelligence doesn't exist because if it did, the human race would be at risk. But what is your view of artificial intelligence in this particular environment? How are you using it? What are you trying to achieve with AI or machine learning, if that's a better terminology?
Sure. So yeah, I guess to me, artificial intelligence is any sign of intelligence from a system. So I think what we're trying to replace is, previously we've done a lot of statistical analysis. So we did design of experiments and linear regression on our formulation spaces. So we would have columns of what materials we put in and their quantities, and then we'll try and match that against responses. So viscosity, end user properties, and other outputs. And what we're trying to achieve using machine learning is, rather than using linear regression, we're looking to use neural networks instead. And these offer a different way of processing our data. The idea being that they're just a bit more effective at producing accurate predictions, but they are sometimes a bit less interpretable by the human.
Can you explain neural networking a little bit more for me at all?
So the idea is that you have your inputs, and these will then feed into a node. There's different weightings associated with them. So it's very similar to how you would do linear regression, I guess, but not always using a linear form. So that's the first layer. But with neural networks, you have multiple layers, and at each stage, you're predicting the next node, and you get to the result. And by setting randomly the weightings at the start, you iterate around to try and improve these weightings so that your prediction is more accurate, and you reach a certain point whereby changing the weightings doesn't improve your accuracy anymore on the predictions. In terms of machine learning, we've tried to explain to our chemists who are not as familiar with it that it's not necessarily something completely outlandish to them. They're all fairly comfortable with the idea of linear regression, but what it's doing is just iterating around to generate a new model using similar techniques, but not exactly the same.
We spoke earlier with Professor Gareth Conduit of Intelligens, and I know you've been working with Intelligens in a lot of your machine learning research. What were some of the challenges that you came across, and how were they able to help you overcome those?
Yeah, sure. So I guess we could go to some open source machine learning platforms like Skylearn or others, and we could have put in our data sets to those and generated some predictions. But we found that whilst these are very good for more traditional problems for machine learning, there's particular issues for formulation science that we need to kind of, that the Alchemite platform is able to cater towards. So one of the main things that we need to ensure is that our formulations can be physically made. So the first thing is that all of the materials have to sum to one, or a fraction of one. And this means that it is a ratio of the materials rather than having something that's 120%, which can't be made. The other thing that we need to ensure is that we're able to set a lower threshold on the materials. So if you've done optimization of formulations, you may find that sometimes a model will give you a material to be added at 0.0001%, which isn't really feasible in production scale. So the Alchemite platforms allowed us to set lower thresholds and say, either put this material in at 5% or above, or just don't include it at all. And this has been really helpful for screening our materials so we can see which ones have the greatest influence on the result. I guess the other thing as well is, traditionally when you're discussing machine learning, you're normally considering big data sets. So these are ones with potentially millions of rows of data. And this isn't something that we have. So whilst we have made efforts to generate larger data sets, we're still only talking about a few thousand rows, which in the grand scheme of things isn't that big.
We talked with Gareth earlier about the sparsity of your data. So that was something they were able to help with as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We have quite a lot of different tests that would measure against an ink, but we wouldn't always necessarily measure every ink against all of the tests. So this really leads to a lot of sparsity within our data set. So we may only have a small fraction of our inks tested against certain properties. Traditionally, you may either omit the missing rows, which really further limits our data set down, or you may introduce a mean average to the missing values, and that is really misleading for the model, particularly when the majority of the results are not there. I'm sure Gareth explained very well how the Alchemite platform iterates around to predict these missing values, but we've found that really helps our predictive capabilities of our data sets. And by using measurements that we did take to inform the missing values, it's able to help us maximize where we have relatively cheap tests that we can run very quickly and easily. We can measure them as a standard, and then that will inform some of the more expensive tests, and we can know whether or not it's worth measuring a certain ink for that property or not.
So are there other benefits that you're seeing because of using machine learning, or is it all around this efficiency piece?
There's certainly the efficiency. I think one thing that we have found is that during a project, we will potentially have materials that we thought we could use at the beginning, and this was dropped out during the process, and we may want to switch that with another one. Where we worked before using factorial design of experiments, these were relatively expensive in the sense that there was a lot of samples we'd have to make that formulation space. If we did move outside of that formulation space, it's relatively difficult to then include a new material into there, so you need to have another big round of formulations. The Alchemite platform, the way it works for adaptive design, it's allowed us to be a lot more agile in our product development. So if we do find that materials are not able to be used, or if we want to potentially look at a new area of specification, we can actually quite quickly use all of the data we've collected historically to then inform our next round of experiments to try and probe this new area of formulation space.
Now, I understand this is sort of part of a wider digitization and automation program at Domino. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Definitely. I guess anyone listening who's keen to go into this way of using machine learning to help formulation, I guess the first thing to say is what you need is relatively clean, nice structured data sets. And as a department, we realized kind of 5-6 years ago, this is where we'd like to be. So we put a lot of time and effort into generating in-house software, which allows our chemists to record the formulations that they develop in labs, and then also the measurements against them. And this has really been the foundation for where we've been able to get to for our data analysis and machine learning, because we have all of our data in a nice centralized place, which is easily reported from. The other thing that we've started to do is to introduce high throughput equipment into our formulation labs. So we have a formulation robot which has doubled our throughput capacity of formulations, and this has really been beneficial so that we can explore more novel formulation space areas. We also have some high throughput equipment to do measurements. So viscosity is very important for our inks because we need to formulate within a tight specification for that. So introducing a viscosity, a high throughput viscometer, we're able to measure a lot more formulations and get very accurate models for our viscosity.
You talk about the formulations. You talked earlier about data sets and your scientists. Has your team had to change the way they work with this process? Has it made the process easier for them? Has it added in complications?
So I'd say in terms of the wider digitalization, where we were developing the software that they would interact with in-house, we've been able to really influence how that was used by the teams. And we were very keen to make sure that we removed any barriers of uptake, because we were aware, I'm guessing like most companies, people were very comfortable with how they did things. So if they used Excel, they had maybe a template they would make and use that as a standard. So to switch them to a new method of working in the labs was quite a step. So we put a lot of effort into trying to figure out what the pain points were for the team. So if we could attack those, then the adoption by the team would be a lot simpler. So as an example, one of the things that we noticed was COSH and admin around kind of risk assessments and bits was quite annoying for the team. It's definitely something chemists have to do, but it's not why anyone goes into chemistry really. So by developing a platform that could handle that for them and take away a lot of the admin pain, it then introduced the fact that it was a lot easier for them to be using this system than not. And so what we're able to do, almost like some of the big tech companies, is to kind of invisibly capture data around the labs without the chemists having to actually manually input them. And this has given us a lot more data integrity around our data set. So as I mentioned, we have high throughput viscometers, and we have integrated them into our databases so that all of the measurements are automatically recorded. And that's not only recording the actual measurement value, but it's recording all of the metadata and context around that measurement. By doing that, we've tried to minimize the impact on the team so that they're not really noticing too much of a shift in the way they're working, but we're trying to make it their life a lot easier. I'll say using the machine learning platform, that has influenced a bit, because as I mentioned before, traditionally we were looking at more factorial design of experiments where the chemist would have, say, 72 plus samples to make. And this was quite a laborious task and took a long time for them. Whereas with the adaptive design approach, we're focusing more on smaller campaigns of formulations so that they can make a few formulations, feed those back into the model, and hopefully that will inform them where to start formulating next, rather than trying to capture all of the data around the formulation space when they're not always interested in the edge cases.
Sure. So, I mean, it's always that old thing, isn't it? Nobody likes change, but actually when you can prove the change helps them, it makes their life a lot better.
Absolutely, yeah. So as well, being in a centralized database, all of the formulations and measurements, we've been able to generate reporting tools for them. So whereas before they would have to go through their Excel files to pull out the measurement data, put that against the formulations they may have recorded in their paper lab book, it's now within a few clicks they're able to generate their reports, which has saved again a lot of admin time, which the chemists don't necessarily enjoy.
Philip, we're coming towards the end of our time. It's been absolutely fascinating. I've certainly learned a lot more about ink than I thought I was going to do in the production of it. Just before we come to the end, what's next for your project and what's next for you at Domino?
Quite a big question, I guess. But for our project, I think we'd like to continue along the same route. I think we want to include a lot more data to the data model. So at the moment, we're still very much just considering the quantities of each raw material, but we're looking to start to include some of the raw material properties into that. So rather than just saying I've used 5% of binder A, 6% of binder B, we'd like to include the characteristics of that. So 5% of a polymer which has a molecular weight of 10,000, 6% of a polymer that has a molecular weight of 15,000. And by informing the model of the characteristics of the chemicals that we're using, we're hoping that that should allow us to be much better on both our model accuracy, but also when we bring in a new polymer, for example, we'll be able to predict how that's going to perform before we actually go to the lab. And I think that's really where we'd like to get to with a lot of our models. The other thing is that, as I mentioned, this is very much around the formulation space at the moment, but we would like to start to include some of the printer data that we capture, start to build up more of a complete end-to-end approach of our model. So we can say, when we develop an ink, how is that going to look, say, 5 years after it's been in a printer, and is that printer still going to be running? Then I guess for the digitalization, I think the ultimate aim for us is probably by the end of the decade, if we're being optimistic, to start to get to a place where we're at closed loop formulation for routine material replacement. So if we have a machine learning model that's able to inform a automated piece of equipment how to make sample, and that can automatically hand that over to an automated measurement technique that can then automatically feed back into the data model, we should be in a process where we can feed in at the start a specification that we would like to achieve, set some boundaries around that, and then just let the machine go away, iterate through some formulations till it's able to achieve the targets.
Excellent. That sounds absolutely fascinating. I'm a little amused, apologies for my distraction, but as we were coming to the end then, a notification came up on my screen to remind me to buy eggs, and all that went through my head was, next time I buy an egg, I'm going to look at the date printed on the side in a completely different way. Dr. Philip Woolston, thank you very much for your time. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thank you for joining us today, and we hope you've enjoyed learning more about artificial intelligence and machine learning. As always, if you would like to learn more, head over to our website, goodfellow.com, where there is a wealth of information and content available at your fingertips. Next month, we have got a special episode which you won't want to miss. We are talking all about hybrid and electric vehicles, but we will be recording live at Croft Motorsport Circuit. So, for the first time ever, you can head over to YouTube and watch the episode live by the trackside. Alternatively, the episode will also be available on all your usual podcast directories.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. You can access all the information on the website www.materialshub.com/podcast. The images and any case studies mentioned can also be found at goodfellow.com. This podcast is also available on alternative podcast directories, including Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podchaser, Deezer, TuneIn, Overcast, and many more.
Whether you're an engineer, academic, university student, or involved with engineering in any way, Engineers Without Borders UK want and need you to be part of this movement for change. Make the commitment to global responsibility today and join the movement by visiting www.ewb-uk.org.
My name is Katie Cresswell-Maynard. I'm the Chief Executive of Engineers Without Borders UK. So the reason I became an engineer was because I always wanted to do something that would make a difference. That would make a difference to the planet, that would make a difference to the people that live on this planet. Not just today, but for generations to come. And for me, engineering was exactly that. I could see that I could use both the creative side of my mind as well as my interest for science and maths, but bring them together in a way that I could actually focus all of my attention on making the world a better place. At Engineers Without Borders, a big part of what we do is about putting global responsibility at the heart of engineering decision making. The reason that we think that this is important is because engineering is actually a uniquely global profession. The decisions of engineers, wherever they're working, whatever projects they're working on, and wherever those projects are, have both a local and global impact. especially if we think about civil engineers. So if you think about what a civil engineer does, the type of projects they work on, just down to the very materials that they source to build the buildings that they've designed, those materials will have been dug out of the ground somewhere else in the world and had both environmental and social impact. So much so that apparently, we, as in human beings, are responsible for moving more natural resources every single year than nature itself. I think that's amazing, I think that's inspiring, but along with that comes a great sense of responsibility. And so if you're interested in making a difference to change the lives of people now and in years to come, then why don't you also consider becoming one of these invisible superheroes? Become an engineer and make a difference.